following takes place between 0 minutes and roughly an hour.
Yes. What are you doing?
24. Episode 24. Perfect parody.
Did you see, listeners, the problem with this one is that I personally have never watched an episode of 24, so all this is lost on me.
You never seen any of Jack Bauer saving the world?
I've seen the advert they did for, what was that service that used to send you DVDs in the post?
What was it called? Love Film?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. And I saw him crying when they said no late fees or whatever it was. Jack Bauer crying. But that's the closest I've come to it, Phil. So, listeners, look, I hope you're all rolling in the aisles at Phil's little intro there. Welcome to episode 24. What have we got? Oh, hold on. Shall we, Phil, before we go through our little here's what you've got to listen to for the next hour or so.
Not got to, get to.
Get to, is that what I meant? As in, here's what you have got, as in, this is what you have.
All the good things coming your
way. That's what I meant. People don't have to do it. Blah, blah, blah. Basically, listeners, when you like pick a packet of cereal off the shelf, maybe it's your favourite, maybe it's got a bit of chocolate on the inside. You know what you're going to get every time you pick that packet off the shelf. And so we figure we're going to ditch the fortnightly thing where you got what we've been watching one week and other stuff the other week, and we're going to give you the same thing every week. So yeah, exciting.
So this week we have got movie reviews, which are Bad Neighbours 2. Laurie, you've gone to see, what was it?
Florence Foster Jenkins.
And that's the new Meryl Streep movie, isn't it, with Hugh Grant?
Yes.
And some emails. And we've also got what we've been watching this week, which is actually now this week rather than fortnightly.
Literally this week, yeah.
And then also we've got a little feature on comedy sequels inspired a bit by Bad Neighbours 2.
Correct, Phil. Yeah, let me say again, we're proud to be supported by Odeon Cinemas, especially George Street and Magdalen Street in Oxford. Thanks, guys, helping us to get to as many movies as we can. We saw all of our movies there this week, so yeah. Well, I bet you're not salivating, that's the wrong word, but your ears are burning. What's a word that, you know, audio anticipation, Phil?
Popping with excitement.
Popping with excitement. Really good, well done. Let's dig in. Episode 24, here we come. You know what I'm saying? Right, well, Phil, I hope you won't mind if I take us through Florence Foster Jenkins first, because I have a sense from you and from me that Bad Neighbours 2 might not be exactly an upbeat listening experience.
I mean, I'll try and keep upbeat, but it doesn't really give us much to go on, does it?
Yeah. So there's a little spoiler for Bad Neighbours 2 review, but I can really happily say that if you have seen Florence Foster Jenkins advertised on billboards or on your cinema now showing list, and you're a bit confused, you know, what's that? Doesn't mean anything to me. Go and watch it. I think anyone would have a lovely time watching this movie.
Anyone?
Anyone, Phil.
Even some East Londoner?
Yeah, I think it's great fun. I mean, one of the good scenes in the movie is there's a whole load of army guys, army Joes. Can I call them army Joes?
Yeah.
From the Second World War, who turn up to listen to this lady sing, and they have a whale of a time. So I think it could be for anybody.
Yeah, okay, what's the basic premise?
So by way of introduction, let me just play this clip. This is Florence Foster Jenkins has just done her first singing lesson in a while. And this is the reaction to it from herself, her husband, played by Hugh Grant. You've got Cosmin McMoon, piano accompanist, and the maestro, who I believe conducts the choir or something at the Met, Phil. Do you know what the Met is?
Yes, I do.
I don't really know, but that's what it is. Okay, so here's the clip.
There's work to be done, but you've never sounded better.
Oh! Yeah.
Maestro, it is true that a lot of singers my age are on the decline, but I seem to just get better and better.
I know, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, I am so blessed.
There is no one quite like you.
So what I've edited out of that clip there is the actual performance that she gives during that lesson, because I think it's best experienced first time in the cinema.
Okay, so is it a bit of a surprise then?
It's kind of a surprise. I'll just say it's better. It's best experienced in the cinema for the first time, yeah.
Okay, cool. So do you want to give a little plot summary?
So this is based on the real life of a lady called Florence Foster Jenkins, who is famous. Well, in her most famous thing is being titled perhaps the worst singer of all time.
Okay, so...
Yeah, which may or may not be fair. You might have your own opinion on that after watching this movie. She is a rich lady, socialite in 1940s New York during the Second World War, who is absolutely in love with classical music. In particular, it would seem, opera. She is common law married. Do you know that phrase, Phil?
I have not come across that phrase.
Well, so she's in a common law marriage with Hugh Grant. I believe it means basically people just see them as married, as opposed to them having actually been legally
officially married. Okay.
I'm a little bit confused about it. I looked up a definition and I still don't really understand it.
But common law.
Hugh Grant plays her husband, and he kind of is more of like a manager to her in her social appearances and in the parties that she does. And in, well, she does these things called tableau vivants. She owns her own club called the Verdi Club for music lovers of New York, where, and the tableau thing is, it's kind of like a miniature performance where someone plays some music and then there are props brought on and people come on stage and they almost stage a picture.
Right, okay.
And she's involved in all that kind of stuff. And yeah, so there's this kind of hip happening, slightly underground artsy scene. And the thing is, she loves music so much, she decides that she doesn't just want to do it for her club. She wants to start performing again and opening things up to the public. And, well, we all suddenly discover what her singing qualities are like. Let me put it that way.
Mm. So it's played by Meryl Streep, isn't it?
Yeah, quite right. In the title role, Meryl Streep plays Florence Foster Jenkins, and she plays her exceptionally well, I have to add.
Does Meryl Streep ever not play it exceptionally well?
I think so. I didn't like her in Mamma Mia. I didn't understand that film. One thing to watch out for, man, is that it is quite a remarkable vocal performance of Meryl Streep. She had a tall order to do, because she's got to do something that sounds awful but doesn't sound so awful, and is a really strange right on the line in the middle business. I think it's amazing.
Well, there you go. Is it played for laughs or is it a drama?
That is the key question that the film asks of the audience, I think. What I can't deny is there are scenes in there that are clearly played for comic effect. So you know The Big Bang Theory's Howard?
Yep, Howard Wolowitz.
Yeah, and the actor is Simon Helberg. He, in this, plays Cosme McMoon, who is the kind of small, quite skinny, and very softly spoken, gentle pianist that she chooses to accompany her during these lessons. And he becomes her concert accompanist as well, playing in even right into Carnegie Hall, that famous music venue in New York. And there is a scene where he accompanies her quite early on that is one of the funniest scenes I've watched in a very long time.
Really? Is that that funny?
His face is just extraordinary. I think you'll be cracking up. I think it's not possible to keep a straight face during that scene. What's amazing is it's quite a sustained passage where the joke and the situation is the same, but just using his face and different expressions and minute little glances and things, it just gets funnier and
funnier. So he milks it for all it's worth.
Yeah, but in an expert way. He's a good master of comedy, that guy. Much, much far away from what you see him do in The Big Bang Theory.
I mean, he was also in Saving Mr. Banks, the Disney retelling of the story behind Mary Poppins.
He was the pianist in that, wasn't he?
He was one of the Sherman brothers, the writers of all the Mary Poppins music and kind of Disney legend, and I thought he was good in that as well.
Yeah, he's obviously quite a talented guy. I thought that was interesting that he's one of the guys who seems to be breaking out of The Big Bang Theory, because I've seen, what's his name, Sheldon Cooper do other things, but he tends to play the same guy, doesn't he, all the time?
Yeah, same sort of character. This guy seems much more sort of versatile.
Well, watch this film, and I think you'll be impressed by the performance he delivers. But yeah, and even, you know, Hugh Grant, man, it's just worth a quick note on Hugh Grant. He plays a very smooth operator who nevertheless manages to communicate a huge range of emotion, but within a polished exterior throughout the whole film. And although I did notice one thing about this film, I don't think Hugh Grant can cry.
Oh, really?
I think that is an actorial, can I say that? A dramatic skill that he lacks.
Well, I mean, it's quite a common one, isn't it? It's of all the acting abilities, crying is the kind of pinnacle, isn't it?
Well, I wonder what anyone else thinks who's seen the film, but I think he actually just can't do it.
He's not able to cry.
Yeah, well, see what you think, man. Go watch the film.
Something which I have been wondering about this from seeing trailers and things like that. My worry is that basically I would find it irritating, because there's that thing with somebody who's slightly deluded and that being a frustrating experience rather than a funny one. Is there any frustration in that?
Well, so you pulled out the key dramatic element of the film, which is this lady clearly thinks she is rather good at what she's doing. There's a great clip at some point in the movie in the recording studio where they say, well, should we do another take? And she's like, well, I don't know why. That one was fine. And she clearly believes she's good at it. She wants to share music with everybody. She invites people to these concerts. But I think delusion and what delusion really means and looks like is right at the core of the film, and it asks a good question. If you look at all the characters in the film, this is a sort of miniature analysis, Phil.
Okay.
That does actually answer your question. Apologies.
does it?
I think the film deliberately paints all the characters in it as deluded in some way or another.
So it's challenging our perceptions of what is good and bad.
Well, it's questioning, you know, what really is the problem with this lady's apparent delusion that she believes she's a better singer than she is. Incidentally, which isn't that rare, anyone who's thinking, whoa, well, this is weird, what about The X Factor? I mean, that show is built on the fact that people love to laugh at people who think they can sing. Right?
Yeah, totally.
I think The X Factor is much more mean-spirited than this, because actually it's asking, is there some good, is there some virtue in this kind of delusion? And in particular, what I thought is that her delusion leads her to acts of generosity. Generosity of spirit, you know, giving people purpose, giving people opportunities. Whereas everyone else's delusion in the film is self-serving.
I mean, what I guess the root of my question was the fact that you don't spend an hour and a half with one of those X Factor contestants. You spend about 3 minutes and then they get booed off.
But that's what I mean. And the reason the X Factor guys is annoying is because they're there because they think they should be a big star from their talent, right? And so I think people feel, well, who do you think you are? Well, I'm going to laugh at you on stage.
Whereas Florence Foster Jenkins
is... Well, that's what I mean. Her, she is doing it out of generosity, or in the film, it doesn't appear to really be for her so much as for everybody else. She believes she is bequeathing everybody a marvelous gift. So then I think it makes it possible for you to laugh at her and with her and at everyone else. It's quite a peculiar sort of comic context, yeah.
And were you laughing all the way through, or was it just sort of at moments?
Laughing, you know, moved at different points, engaged throughout. And New York, which it turns out is Liverpool. I think they
really?
Thought, yeah. Looks fantastic, 1940s New York.
One final question, which I think might get me in the bad books with some people. How Meryl Streepy is Meryl Streep's performance?
Well, what's really good about it, and I know exactly what you mean by that, Phil, is that she's playing such a sympathetic character in the movie that she could be, you know, 100%, 150% Meryl Streepy, and you'd still be able to enjoy watching her because her character literally exists in her own little world. And so you're an observer. Do you know what I mean? So she's not Meryl Streeping in your face.
She's Meryl Streeping around you.
Yeah, exactly. She's Meryl Streeping in her own face, in her own kind of world. And so, you know, I know exactly what you mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Hopefully that communicates to listeners as well. What sort of grade would you give it?
I would give this an A-. I think it's really thoroughly enjoyable. And it's got a great heart to it. If you're going historical accuracy, then yeah, that's not what this film offers. And if anyone out there is tempted to go to Wikipedia or YouTube and look up the real Florence Foster Jenkins, I would suggest don't do that until you've seen this film.
I have to say, you have managed to make it sound more interesting than I thought it was. I think I remember seeing a trailer for Meryl Streep's last film where she was playing sort of an aged rocker mum or something like that, and I just thought that looked terrible.
Which one was that?
Something in the Flash, Ricky in the Flash.
No, go watch her in this. She's really good. And it's an entrancing sort of character. And, you know, throughout the film, people say, oh, I think you love her a bit too. And there's a lot of happiness and, oh, we love Florence and we're devoted to her. And I think most people, if they go and watch it, will feel that way.
Okay, well, there you go. If you agree with Laurie, let us know. If you disagree with us, or Laurie in this case, do let us know as well. You can reach us at superbaileybros.com or tweet us at Super Bailey Bros.
Yeah, please do. And final thing, along with not being able to cry, I've discovered something that Hugh Grant does, man.
What does he do?
A Hugh Grantism. He's leaving. He's in a conversation and he turns to walk away. And he does this thing where he slightly leans forward and does like almost a half bow and then turns while bowed so that he kind of like does this weird...
Like a pivot.
Yeah, kind of at a strange pivot and kind of almost half backs away and swivels around and then eventually straightens up to walk away again. And it's a real Hugh Granty thing. He does it all the time and he does it in this film.
Okay, the Hugh Grant pivot.
I can't really think of a better way to describe it.
No,
really
that sounds
strange.
Interesting. If I do watch this film, and I have to say you have convinced me a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's great fun. I really recommend it.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Cool.
Lastly, are we actually doing points, by the way? Where's our point score?
I thought we were on 0-0 right now. Are we not? We had some minuses and some pluses.
We went up and down a bit and yeah.
I'm pretty sure we're on 0-0 right now. I need to hear some more opinions.
So if you agree with Laurie, this is the time to get your points in. Plus ones for if you agree with him, minus ones for Laurie if you disagree.
Exactly right. We're on even keel and we can't have that because we're super competitive.
Here we go. Bad Neighbours 2. Laurie, take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. Breathe through the pain. We'll crack through it. I think you probably can already guess how we're feeling a bit about it, but we'll try and say something interesting and pull out some positive things as well as negative and try and get to the bottom of why we reacted to this film the way we did. So the basic premise is very similar to the previous film with a couple of changes. Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, they've just sold their house and their house is in escrow, which I didn't really know what it was, but neither did they, so that's fine.
And sorry, and escrow is they've got this 30-day window where even though a sale has been agreed, the buyers can pull out if they suddenly decide, whoa, we don't want to make this commitment.
And cue movie plot, a sorority has bought the house next door, led by Chloe Moretz of Kick-Ass and Hugo. So understandably, here comes some problems.
Oh, here comes hilarity, Phil, surely.
Some comedy japes.
Oh, yep, some japes. Oh, we've all been there, haven't we? Do you remember when you were in a fraternity, Phil, and drugs are so funny and beer is really hilarious? Do you remember those times?
Yeah, I do. No,
yeah, you know what? Yeah, no, neither do I. No.
So there's the comedy sort of setup, which actually I think is quite a straightforward setup, a really easy kind of almost home run setup. The one interesting element is Zac Efron returns as the frat dude
Teddy,
and he this time is recruited to help the I can't remember their
well
character
Phil, herein lies the joke in the early stages of the film. All his previous frat buddies, who all cause terrible problems, they're all super successful. They've become really successful in what, 2 years, is it about?
2 or 3 years.
Yeah, they've turned their life right around from their frat partying days. So why don't we hear that clip while they all sum up their ridiculous achievements?
Yeah, so I've been designing Outback Steakhouses.
Congrats.
Got lots of Outbacks. But dude, tell me what's going on with your app, changing the world?
I meant to tell you, I enjoyed your TED Talk.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for watching.
You're so successful.
Well, I mean, I'm still a cop, you know, which is not that bad. Not that bad. I mean, you know, it's a lot of rules now. We got to wear body cameras and all of that. And I don't know why they gave me one. It's not like I'm going to shoot myself. But hey, I figured, look, if you can't beat them, join them.
What are you up to, man? How you doing?
Oh, yeah, that's what.
Work's been like a little bit of a bummer, you know. They eliminated the shirtless models, so now I have to walk around in this monkey suit.
Looks like a really soft sweater.
Yeah, you know what else, too? I'm the oldest person there now by like 6 years. I had to cover for my boss, Mason, because he had to go to his prom. Yeah. Wait, did everyone in retail get so young?
So there he is, poor Zac Efron. There's an awkward silence that comes after that clip where everyone thinks, oh gosh, Zach, you know, he was king of the crew back in the day, alpha male number one, and now here he is, still in retail. Because, Phil, retail's an awful thing to be doing with your life, isn't it?
It's the lowest of the low.
Yeah, that's what this film told me.
Well, should we, rather than just sort of attacking it, should we get into actually what the movie is like? What did you think of the movie?
I really didn't think it was good at all. No, I thought it was exhausting. It was noisy. Honestly, I identified not with the actual characters, because they're not relatable either, but with the situation of the married couple living next door to this loud sorority of girls who throw wild parties. I just wanted the film to be quiet and go away. I wanted the film to switch off the lights and go to bed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's late. We just want all got to go home.
Yeah, I spent the whole film just being really annoyed at the noise and at the chaos, because it is chaotic, isn't it?
It's very chaotic. I couldn't really believe how it was edited and directed. I never felt like it was ever comfortable in its own skin. The editing was really, really choppy. And actually, the way the film is structured, it has almost these episodes in the narrative that don't necessarily follow on from the previous little
segment.
It just sort of starts happening. And you're like, oh, okay, I'm in this scene now. And there's no sort of build up to that scene or explanation of why that would happen. It just, things happen for the sake of the movie. So that they can get to these set
and it
pieces.
Happens very quickly as well. It's only 93 minutes the runtime of this movie. Do you
is
think
is it really?
Yeah,
I honestly thought it felt so long.
But do you know, does that go some way to explaining what you're talking about with the disjointed stuff and there's no build-up? I wonder whether they just cut out a load of rubbish.
Yeah, the first film didn't have that feeling, and it was directed by the same person, so maybe they had loads of ideas in this one and then they realized, oh, this is all going a bit pear-shaped, let's just get through it quickly.
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, the first film, it has to be said, it was made for about $18 million and it made over $200 million.
Seriously?
Yeah, that's how comedy sequels get made. If they do well, they make a sequel. And so you feel like they're just cranking this one out. And actually, it feels like this film maybe has more of a justification for a sequel. They've already done the frat house. Let's do a sorority. That feels like quite a normal Hollywood reason to make a sequel. But this film, I don't think it is as good as the first one. I didn't really like the first one. And this one's worse.
Yeah, well, what are your principal reasons for saying that? I think one of the things, I mean, I haven't seen the first Bad Neighbours, but tell me about the script in the first one, because I couldn't get over how every scene appeared to have been improvised. The actors who are speaking their lines, either, is it Chloe Grace Moretz who's the lead?
She's the lead of the sorority, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever she was saying, I felt like I could tell when she was saying a line that was scripted and when it wasn't, because when it was scripted, she delivered it really badly, like she's in drama class, I thought. And then when she was delivering a line that appeared to have been improvised, it was just apropos of nothing. And everyone was looking around them like they were afraid of what was going to come out of the person's mouth next. And I felt like Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, a lot of their scenes were like that too. Was it improvised or what? Am I making this up?
I it wouldn't surprise me. The first film, it definitely felt like there were blocks of the film where there was improvisation allowed.
Right.
So you could normally tell by the camera angles. If it's A, B, and there's not much variation, it just seems to go back and forth. You almost feel like, oh, let's try another take. Let's try this one. And it'll just be, let's say something random in my head, which is so funny. And I felt like there was more of that in this film. There was some in Bad Neighbours, but it didn't feel as loose as this film did. This film, I agree with you. Chloe Moretz, who I think is an okay actress from what I've seen her in before, she was terrible in this film.
I thought so.
There wasn't really any distinction between the characters in terms of their values or their morals or their comedic style. They were all trying to be the same sort of funny, which is really bizarre, and it all kind of meant that they were all faceless.
Do you think part of it is because it's written by five men?
Well, so I did notice how many people were the writers on this film. I put inverted commas around that because they're not really writing anything if it is this much improvisation.
Yeah, but also it's five men making a movie where the predominant characters are sorority girls. I find that odd.
I've been around a sorority. Well, some of my friends are in sororities.
Yeah, but
sororities.
You didn't have the audacity to write a movie about it.
No, but I reckon I could probably write a better one than they did.
Oh, ouch.
Genuinely, I was thinking, this is a perfectly fine movie premise.
Was there anything about it that you did like?
There was one joke about eggs and pasta, which I liked.
Okay, I know the one you're talking about. Well, say what it is, that's fine.
Okay. Seth Rogen is helping Teddy, Zac Efron, learn how to boil a hard-boiled egg. And he says, well, why does it make it hard? And he's like, what are you talking about? It's a hard-boiled egg. But then he's like, well, but if you put pasta in, it makes it soft. And then Seth Rogen's confused.
Okay, fair enough. That one isn't too bad. There were one or two funny jokes I picked up. Like the first one, no one can spell sorority. They try to spell it off the top of their head and no one can do it.
And then something is silent. I like that one.
That was a nice little one-liner. And another one, Zac Efron says, are there any more of these? And he's holding up, for any parents out there, like one of those Ella's Kitchen squeegee baby fruit things. And they said, yeah, there's some in the kitchen. He's like, well, babies eat good food, which is pretty good. But to be honest, they're the only two jokes that are really any good, I thought. The rest was pretty dire. They're more or less my highlights for the whole movie.
I did see two people leave the cinema, up leave the cinema about two-thirds in.
I think, it, to be fair to the film, it's very upfront about what it's going to contain at the very beginning, so you will know. I think I was particularly annoyed with how frequently drugs were referenced as kind of overall as a positive life experience.
Well, I mean, it seems to be a particular trend of Seth Rogen films. One of my friends, my housemate Jacob, he mentions how he just doesn't really, whenever he watches a Seth Rogen film, he doesn't really get it because he's not into weed. And so how are you meant to relate to it if you're not a weed smoker?
It makes an assumption that everyone feels the same way.
And it seems to be almost quite a childish thing. It's like, hey, weed's awesome. I love weed. Weed's so great. And it just seems like grow up a bit.
Well, I completely agree. Do you know what the single shining light for me, Phil, was?
What was it?
It was a really badly constructed question there. Zac Efron, he can't hide his quality as an actor.
He should be doing better stuff. He has done better stuff.
Do you know, there was one moment where, and in a scene that was almost well choreographed, but actually it was just all in poor taste, so I was unable to really enjoy it. But the scene at a party and a kind of market fair, something, I can't think
of. Tailgate party.
Thank you, tailgate party.
Do you want me to explain what that is?
Go on then.
Tailgating is the party that goes on around a game, around a football match. So in the parking lot, they go and have like food and drinks and
okay,
that sort of stuff.
So there's quite a funny scene there, which is there's a little mission that they go under to steal something from these sorority girls, and they have a distraction, they have people dressed up like football fans or whatever else it is, and there's a couple of scenes in there where Zac Efron is doing the running and the chasing, where I suddenly thought, this guy, he could literally do any number of film roles. Like, he could be an action hero, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or he could convincingly play a Mission Impossible character, right? That kind of stuff. And I just thought, what is he doing in this movie? It makes me wonder whether his PR manager is running his sort of film choices so that he goes through enough of a period of choosing really dumb frat boy comedies that he has managed to successfully ditch his Disney image from High School Musical and he can follow the same career path as Matthew McConaughey.
Interesting. I mean, what's funny about Zac Efron is...
and that means, incidentally, to then become a serious actor and ditch all the frat boy stuff. Do you know what
I mean? Like the McConaissance, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. What's interesting about Zac Efron, though, is he's already kind of done critically acclaimed movies. He did Me and Orson Welles. He's done the sort of art house movies, and I think he's got quite a lot of acclaim for those films.
Is that like The Life and Death of Charlie St. Cloud? Is that Zac Efron?
Yeah, which was a very serious sort of drama film. I feel like he's managed to pretty much shake High School Musical. It's a shame because I genuinely think he's a really talented actor.
I think you can even see it in this
film.
And
he's sort of an old school top level movie star. He's a triple threat.
The triple threat.
He can sing, he can dance, and he can act.
No, I thought it was overall a shame. I don't have that much more to say.
What would you give it as a grade?
A D.
Yeah, I have to agree. I don't think it deserves to get any praise, really.
Nope.
It's not funny enough.
Okay, I reckon. Let's move on, man.
Okay, cool.
Okay, only a couple of emails, quick ones, because we mentioned last week that people who sent in emails to us about the Jungle Book, we were going to cover that here because we ran out of space in last week's episode. So I'm going to start, Phil, with a blog post.
Hit me.
Right.
Blog me.
And Nicholas says, I'm surprised by your review as most critics love it, but I do understand your points.
Yeah, it seems like I'm in the minority.
Well, I wasn't a massive fan, but I didn't hate it as much as you, certainly.
I think maybe I judged the movie in its wider context rather than just the movie. I think the movie was okay.
Okay, well, he goes on to say, I remember the original one as a pleasant adventure with a groovy soundtrack and likable characters, but he was actually, watching it again, a bit surprised that the plot is fairly thin with one-dimensional characters, the old one. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I don't think that's a problem.
In particular, he says Baloo, he feels, is the only character who evolves in that old film, and this is Baloo the bear suddenly realising that he can't just have a wonderful lazy time all to himself and that there are things that need to happen and responsible choices in life, that kind of thing. Whereas everyone else just carries on their merry way.
I mean, for me, the older cartoon was all about Mowgli almost having these random encounters with these different animals, and each animal represents a different angle on the situation he's in and are giving him reasons why he doesn't fit into the jungle.
Sure.
It's sort of like each one is motivating him more and more that he doesn't fit with the elephants, he doesn't fit with Bagheera, he doesn't fit with the wolves, he doesn't fit with the snakes, he definitely can't fit with the orangutans. The only place for him that he can possibly go is the village.
Well, and this is, well, Nicholas here has something to add. He thinks that final ending has been misinterpreted by us. If you remember, we gave three possible interpretations of that Jungle Book ending, and he says Mowgli hasn't matured or learned anything. He just sees a bird what he fancies, right?
Yeah, but again, I think that's all tying into the idea that he is a man. Like, it's built into him. That's what he's meant to be. He isn't like the other animals. He's not this sort of super complex character. He's Mowgli. He's a little boy, and he's enchanted by, like, a little girl who he thinks is beautiful. It doesn't need to be deeper than that. He is not meant to be in the jungle.
Well, there we go, listeners. Maybe that's provoked your little discussion box. Thanks very much for that comment there, Nicholas. But anyway, here's another email that we got, and this one is about the new film itself, not the old one.
Okay.
So this is from Susanna, and she says, hey, guys, sorry it's taking me so long to get in touch.
But no worries at all.
No,
happy to
thank
hear
you
me
for doing so. She adds quickly, before we talk about The Jungle Book, does the fact that we go there and we review and we analyse films now on the podcast, has it changed the way that we watch movies? Do we enjoy it as much anymore?
Doesn't make me enjoy seeing Bad Neighbours 2.
No, definitely not.
I definitely don't think I would have seen that movie if I wasn't doing this podcast. But I think otherwise it's made me appreciate all the complex layers of films.
I agree with you there, man. The reason we do it is because we love movies. And to be fair, the more stuff I discover about them, the more I love them. I like it more the more I analyse.
They're a very rich medium.
Oh, quite right. Quite right, Phil. Okay,
so
yeah.
Fantastic.
So she goes on to say, Jungle Book verdict. Overall liked it, but weird at the same time. She thought Mowgli, who is played by Neil Sethi, did a really good job, considering he's just a little boy. Well, I don't think he was particularly even an actor before, was he?
I think he was discovered for this film.
Yeah, and he was in a big warehouse having to act, presumably, to blue tennis balls.
Yeah, he did do a good job of, like, selling his environment.
He managed to react fairly believably. He, in many ways, well, he was the most believable thing in the film.
He was the only believable.
Right, yeah. So she enjoyed Bill Murray as Baloo, but she just can't get away from Phil Harris's Baloo. His vocal performance and the songs were just so perfect, and the mannerisms seemed to fit the bear so well. And this Bill Murray, no matter how great Bill Murray is, just couldn't do that with this CGI bear.
Yeah, I think there's a reason why voice actors are a different kind of category to film actors. I think voice acting is a real talent.
Well, I think Bill Murray's got good vocal skills, but it's just, overall, it wasn't quite the same sort of fit. I think they just needed the cartoonishness of those expressions and to really sell it, whereas this one, it was too serious. How can you be like a charming lazy bear who's literally a bear? She then adds, unfortunately, worse was yet to come. Christopher Walken as King Louis. Good match character-wise, she thinks, but just could not get over his singing. And also the fact that he wasn't an orangutan anymore, he was a Gigantopithecus.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, I looked that up, a Gigantopithecus. Susanna actually agrees with me. She particularly says the fact that he had massive overhanging nipples the whole time.
You know, that did really bother me as well. I was just like, why? Don't need to see that.
Sit in the rain all the wrong ways. You can't really take your eyes off them in a couple of scenes. She's like, ew, no, put them away.
Yeah, do put them away. There's no need for them.
And I think you'll understand it. She says, wow, sorry, didn't think I'd be writing an essay. I know you will summarize this into like one sentence, which is fine. Thanks for reading. Well, Susanna, you'll know. No one else will ever know, but you will know just how that email has been summarized. But we really appreciated all of it. And I hope you're glad with the way we read it out. She says, keep up the good work. You're very welcome. Thanks for emailing.
Actually, that's a good point. If you do want to get an email read out, if you're nice and brief and witty and short, that's probably the best way to do it, isn't it?
It's true. We love getting long emails, but we try to be slick. Do you think we could ever describe ourselves as slick?
We're slick like an oil slick.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make sense. There's a good example of our slickness, listeners. But it's much easier for us if you make them fairly short and to the point, because then it's easier to slide it in. You wouldn't believe how much longer it takes to read something out than read it in your head. So keep them short. But Susanna, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nice. Okay, well, there's the emails over, guys. Thanks very much.
What have we been watching this week?
Now, Phil, are you pleased that the
woo's coming? You didn't expect the woo, did you?
No, I really didn't. I started talking. So, are you prepared for the fact that you may not have hit the right key? I'm just listening and I don't have perfect pitch or anything, but I just have a feeling you might have missed it there.
That's okay. You know, I've been listening to some really trendy Radio 1 music, and sometimes, you know, Kanye West doesn't even hit the notes. So I'm
okay
with
that. You're emulating Kanye.
Yeezy can hang with me, is what I'm saying.
He's so trendy, listeners. I don't even know what half those words meant. Okay, Phil, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I thought I'd watch something to cleanse my palate from Bad Neighbours 2. And I watched 17 again. Zac Efron is playing a 17-year-old.
Version of Chandler from Friends.
Yeah, Matthew Perry. So it's one of those classic sort of body switch type of comedies. So a bit like Freaky Friday, a bit like 13 going on 30. This time, Matthew Perry is down on his luck about how his life is going. He's getting a divorce from his wife. And he's feeling very sad and a bit like, why have I wasted my life? I wish I could go back to when I was 17 and everything was great. Cue magical, weird old man who makes that possible.
Of course. It's always good. It's got to be a weird, magical man or lady in these things.
And it just so happens that Matthew Perry, when he's 17, he is, in fact, Zac Efron. What I quite liked about this movie is that rather than it sort of jumping back the whole, all of time to when he was 17 and he's just reliving his life, what this does is his current age in his current world, he just becomes a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
And so he suddenly is in a situation where he's going to school with his own children.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've not seen that done before. It's cool.
And he's friends with his own son. And so he gets invited round to his house. And so he sees his wife, but as a 17-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of that just really works. It reminds me a bit about Back to the Future.
Well, I was just going to say, but in reverse. So then it's the son going and hanging out with his parents as teenagers, but this one's the other way around, yeah.
Yeah, the other way around. And of course, when he's hanging out with his kids, he realises his son is a bit of a loser and isn't really very popular. And his daughter is a bit hanging around with the wrong sort of crowd,
yeah.
Dating the bad boy of the school. And it just really works. And I think it really shows off all of Zac Efron's skills. If you want to see Zac Efron be charming and funny and witty and just deliver a really heartfelt performance, there's a couple of scenes which are genuinely quite emotional.
I'd echo that, man, and funny too.
Yeah, and I just think the film really works. It's got a really good spirit, and I think you should check it out. I really think Zac Efron should be doing better things.
Yeah, I agree. Do you know who else is good in that, man? I've just said man already. Man keeps coming back. Leslie Mann, who plays Zac Efron's, wife, or Matthew Perry's wife in that movie.
She was the lady interest in George of the Jungle, wasn't
exactly
she?
Exactly what I was going to say. I think she's really, in a comedy movie, she's great. She's got fantastic sort of control over her facial expression, so she can be very subtle, and she's a brilliant foil for the sort of ludicrous character. So in this, it's Zac Efron kind of being a weird man-child. In George of the Jungle, it's Brendan Fraser. Incidentally, George of the Jungle, we both love, right?
Yeah, good film.
That's got to be what we're watching.
Do it later.
I love that movie. But yeah, she's good. She actually anchors a lot of the film because she gives it legitimacy by reacting to everything that's going on around her.
She plays it straight, doesn't she?
Well, but that's the thing. She's not entirely straight. Actually, she generates quite a lot of the laughs.
Yeah, and I just think it's quite rare these days to get a film which just has a really good heart. I know that sounds super cheesy.
Yeah.
But just one which feels quite wholesome, one which you can actually enjoy if you're 10 years old, or if you're 30 years old, or you're older and you're wanting to watch it with your kids or your family. I just think this is a sort of fun movie, and it's a nice one.
I hear you, bro. Testify. Come on, give me a grade.
I would give it a B plus.
B plus. Great. Okay. Well, I have been watching, sadly, We Bought a Zoo.
Matt Damon and Emily Blunt.
And no, Matt Damon and Scarlett Johansson, Phil.
Scarlett Johansson.
I'm glad to see you're a surprised ScarJo. By that. ScarJo. Because actually, this is a really odd movie. So the basic plot is Matt Damon plays a journalist who's constantly been throwing himself into danger. But nothing could have prepared him for...
Wait, let me guess.
Go on then.
They buy a zoo.
No, well, they do that. I mean, well done. You've really, your powers of, you know...
Deduction.
Insight. That's incredible, Phil, that you managed to deduce that. Well done. But no, that's not really what it is. And this isn't a spoiler because it's right at the beginning of the film. The actual thing is he's a single dad now because he's got two kids. Oh, sadly,
that took a week.
I know. His wife died. Well, no, that reaction you just had, Phil, hang on to that. Your surprise and, oh, that was not really an appropriate response. Hang on to that because that's how you're going to feel throughout the whole movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so his wife sadly died of an unspecified illness, leaving him in charge of these two kids, and he's having to figure out his relationship with them. He can't really handle life because he keeps seeing, like, images, you know, memories of his wife in every shop that he passes, in all the places he goes to, all the people he sees. His son is having a terrible time at school and appears to be having psychological problems. That's almost when you talk about Kevin vibe there. almost, not quite. And he and his son don't get on that well. So what he figures is, I've just got to do something crazy and I've got to do something different and I've got to get out of here. And he goes and buys a zoo.
Yeah, but a much bleaker way of getting to that point, isn't
it? That is exactly what characterizes the experience of watching this movie. It is not what you expect, and it is never what you expect. It tries to score goals that you just, this kind of movie, I don't really think should be aiming for. Every scene becomes a scene that is supposed to fill your heart with kind of pathos and longing or sadness or joy, and it becomes a really emotional ride, like Sigur Rós, that album by Sigur Rós.
Oh,
can you sing it?
You know, those lyrics are completely made up.
The thing was, I actually wanted you to sing.
That is literally the lyrics of that song.
You know, the lyrics.
Don't be hating on my lyrics.
But I don't think the lyrics is what people remember. That soundtrack is used ad nauseam, basically, in trying to convince you that everything.
Super inspirational stuff.
Yeah, and as if every animal that they manage to build a bit of a better enclosure for is treated as an emotional milestone in this guy's self-discovery, right? And the healing process.
The penguin's got a slide.
Yeah, and this film, I just think this film should be funny, right? About how the bear gets loose once and, oh, we managed to entice him back.
That's not
funny.
A funny JP sort of thing, a bear getting loose. Have you ever met a bear?
You know, but this is what I mean. The weirdest thing is the bear does get loose, and that scene amongst all of them is one of the funny ones.
Like, right, okay.
It's all over the shop, and I found it quite a disappointing and slow experience, I'm sorry to say. And the script is really poor. There's a lot of lines that are trying to be emotional and powerful. Like, there's one particular scene during which Matt Damon connects with his son, which is just no good. And Matt Damon, I never realized it before, is exactly like Luke Skywalker. In this film, he has never looked more like Mark Hamill or sounded like him either.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's all I had to say, really.
Great.
C+.
C+.
Yeah, not good.
I've been watching Hercules, Disney's Hercules.
Hercules, woo!
Yeah.
Thanks.
Keep going.
How does the rest of that song go?
Keep going, just keep going.
How about, can I do...
Just do it, Laurie.
Bless my soul, Herc was on a roll. Person of the week in every Greek opinion poll. What a pro, Herc can stop a show. Boy, a man, a monster, and you're talking SRO. How's that going? He was a no one, a zero. Now he's a honcho, he's a hero. I can't get up there.
Keep going.
No, man, he was a kid with his act down pat. From zero to hero, just like that. Don't make me do any more.
This is the sort of thing you do to me.
No.
I love this film. It's such a good Disney film. It's so fun. The music, as you've heard from Laurie, is fantastic. It's
please don't judge the music based on what I did. It's spectacular.
No, but the fact that you remember all those lyrics without any preparation, thanks, I think shows how good the writing is. It's funny. It's interesting. Musically, it's got a real... What sort of genre is it, those muses?
Oh, the muses themselves?
Yeah.
Yes, gospel music. Kind of gospel. That's where the opening song is. That's the gospel truth.
And so they've got these sort of these women, these gospel singing women who are sort of narrating the film. You've got some really good character designs. I really liked how Mount Olympus was shown.
Yeah.
You've got James Woods as the voice of Hades.
He's brilliant. Sarcastic,
impeccable performance.
Talking. Yeah.
And it's actually got some really good action beats to it. Danny DeVito is Philoctetes, the little sidekick.
Satyr.
Satyr, thank you.
Perfectly cast.
he's a satyr who's training Hercules to be a hero and sort of earn his demigod status. Just all of the elements combine really wonderfully to make a fantastic movie, which I think actually is slightly underrated, I think, when people think of the...
Oh, it's completely underrated. It's not well regarded critically, I don't think. Or
really?
Not particularly, or even by Disney fans. I think they're way off base, to use, I think, a lyric from from the song. I don't say I'm in love. I think, you're way off base.
It's just so much fun. And I was thinking about it, because we know we talked about Jungle Book and it's a live-action remake of their own cartoon. Make a live-action remake of Hercules, by all means. That's got so much room.
Oh, but they wouldn't be able to do it like that, man.
No, they wouldn't be able to do it like that, but it's just a great story, and the characters are great. And if they could do a visual action story, because some of the battles in Hercules are just great, and I'd love to see that on a big scale.
They are good, and not because the action itself is amazing. It's a classic mode of action, which is that the beats are really well planned. It's not just a case of the more punches the person gets in, they win. Or it's actually planning, trying something new. There's a sense of adventure to it all. And, you know, the songs are really great. A Place Where I Belong, what is it, that song?
I Can Go the Distance. That's my karaoke classic.
Is it really? That's your choice?
Yeah, one of my housemates could play piano and I just used to get to play it all the time.
Oh, way to go, man.
Yeah, so meaningful. And also, Zero to Hero, I Won't Say I'm in Love. Great songs, great characters, great voice acting. What more do you want?
I particularly think, man, and we keep teasing this feature, it's one of the best paced cartoon films like that I've ever seen, because it's very short runtime, but it feels very full. Like, there's full journeys for almost every single character, emotionally, and even just from a narrative point of view. And not only that, but the exposition in it is amazing. Like, the opening 5 minutes of that film give you more exposition than you can imagine. But they dress it up and they manage to obscure it so you don't feel like you're being force-fed context. It's brilliant.
And that's kind of what you'd expect from Disney. They used to be really masterful storytellers who really knew how to pull out the best of the things. And I wonder if the animation process, the fact that it takes so long to animate something, makes them work really hard on their stories to make sure that they're super efficient, really well told.
You can't waste time with
animation. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't. It costs more money. You've got to be efficient or you're just wasting more money animating something which you don't need to do.
Yeah, no, good call, man. And Tate Donovan, masterful.
Yeah, brilliant. I'm going to give this one an A.
Yes, I'm right there with you, man. Brilliant. Go watch it, guys. Okay, now for my last one, and I'll be quick with this, but it's going to be ever so slightly different because I've seen two films that are so similar, I'm going to review them side by side. Ready for that?
Cool, go.
One of them is called Bear Island, a 1980s mystery thriller slash drama.
Is it B-E-A-R or B-A-R-E?
It's B-E-A-R because Bear Island is a real place. Actually, the southernmost island of the Norwegian Svalbard archipelago, Phil.
Oh, yeah, next to that Waitrose.
Well, it's actually located in the western part of the Barents Sea, approximately halfway between Spitsbergen and the North Cape. It's just information I have stored away in my memory banks.
Not at all right in front of you right now.
No, not at all. Donald Sutherland stars as a scientist who joins a research team who are completely isolated in the snow. You know, one of those little camps that's got a generator.
They're
battling terribly harsh elements. And he is there because his father was a Nazi submarine commander during the Second World War. And he wants to find out a bit more because apparently there was a German base that was near there. So he kind of joins to do research, but also to find out what happened to his dad. And along the way, people start to die in mysterious circumstances and a mystery unfolds. What is the mystery of this research base?
Gotcha.
Okay. That is icy movie number one. Number two is White Out, starring Kate Beckinsale. Also at a research base set in a very snowy wasteland, terrifying generators. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They're doing unspecified just research, Phil. And
everyone's doing research.
And this is in Antarctica, in particular, the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station in
Antarctica. How do you know that, Laurie? How do you do it?
Are you impressed by my knowledge?
You're so knowledgeable.
I know, it is quite impressive. But this is particularly, I think this is actually well known, because this is a place where at a certain point in the year, darkness will come and rain for 6 months.
Rain.
Yes, I'm just using grandiose
language.
Darkness
raining from the stars.
Darkness is going to rain for 6 months. So this US Marshal, Kate Beckinsale, that's fine. She gets on with life fairly normally. But a murder appears to have happened. Someone has died in mysterious circumstances and she needs to solve it in 3 days because after those 3 days, darkness will fall and it'll be impossible to find anything more out. So, you know, it's a murder mystery against the clock.
Tense.
Well, you would think so. Yeah. Okay. So, Bear Island, the way it goes about it, is much, much better than Whiteout because you have the terror of the Arctic sort of snow environment, but it's not so oppressive that you find yourself thinking, why on earth would anyone be out here and how on earth can they live and survive in this place? And actually they just go skiing every now and again, and they appear to actually get on with some scientific research at different points. And the mystery unfolds very gradually. There's a lot of mistrust, but there's also a lot of normality in it as well. So you can kind of believe that this would all be happening while work would also continue. And Donald Sutherland is brilliant in it, I have to admit. It keeps you guessing right up until the very, very final act. And you've all got your guesses about who's done it and why he's done it. And can Donald Sutherland, this scientist, prove himself to be a man? And there's an incredible bare-knuckle fist fight in it as well.
Oh, okay, cool.
Fairly brutal, I have to admit, but it is very well done. So really, really like that. The problem with White Out with Kate Beckinsale is that the film doesn't seem to know how to pitch itself. You know, I mentioned with Bear Island, there's some normality to it, and it seems like a proper science-y place, and there's friendliness.
Whereas
Kate Beckinsale's one almost feels more like a science fiction film, more set in space than in snow, because it's all a bit sort of weirdly military and confusingly futuristic. And people don't appear to do ordinary bits and bobs. There's a lot more about going from one base to the other. And the music that's in there and the lighting of it all presents it rather more like a horror film.
So there's not much to relate to.
No, it feels very alien. And it literally feels like the film Alien in places, because there's lots of dark cargo holds and dark unspecified corridors with loads of electronic equipment. It's kind of a metallic futuristic feel. And there's even, I wonder whether people who do like horror movies may recognise this trope, the opening scene of the film, in a quite disappointing way, is Kate Beckinsale coming back from a walk and deciding to have a shower. And you know, in films that are tense, often you'll do that because you want to create a hero or a heroine who is vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable situation. And Psycho.
Exactly. So you do that at the beginning and you make them sort of vulnerable and you think, oh gosh, she's in a shower, but well, this is a tense film. She shouldn't be doing that because she'll leave herself open to attack, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But actually, that threat never really properly materializes during that film. And there's a really odd scene where the person who's doing the killing gets revealed, and then they just have an ordinary conversation with the guy. And it's very ordinary. Like, not in a kind of Silence of the Lambs creepy way, but in a kind of a, oh, well, is he really the killer then? What's going on? And then it...
Super anticlimactic.
Really anticlimactic. And then even the very, very end is more anticlimactic for the same reasons. I feel sad about it because the performances are rather good. I just thought the direction was really poor. It just wasn't interesting.
Does the darkness in 3 days thing, does that play a part?
That is one of the worst elements of it, because that's why I decided to press record on my little TV button. I thought, whoa, a race against the clock. I bet that's going to be, you know, high action and tense. But that almost plays no part to it whatsoever. That's barely even mentioned until right at the end.
It's just window dressing.
Yeah, and then they just kind of think, oh well.
Into the darkness we go.
It just doesn't, it's not really relevant. It's weird. It's like the best part of their premise and they just let it go. So of the two murders happening in a snowy research station, watch Bear Island and enjoy a bit of... It's actually 1979, not 1980s. Enjoy a bit of old-fashioned mystery. That's good. Bear Island is going to get a B-, I think. It's not perfect, but it's fairly enjoyable. Unfortunately, White Out is going to get a C-.
Okay, there you go. That's what we've been watching this week.
It is.
So here's Bad Neighbours 2. We've already talked about it. What other comedy sequels would you say are really great?
Well, you asked me about this earlier on, Phil, and I've been racking my brains through trying to think of ones that I think are great. Can Back to the Future 2 be called a comedy?
No.
A little bit, though. It is funny.
No.
Okay, fine. So that's not on the list. I think Shanghai Nights is quite good.
Okay, that's the Owen Wilson, Jackie Chan follow-up.
Yeah, only because the expectations are quite low. You know, it's not needing to be an amazing movie. So
that's a kung fu comedy, isn't it?
Yeah, we can talk about that more in a minute if you like, but I thought Shanghai Nights was fairly good. Well, did you have any?
I've got, I think, basically one franchise which I think is really, really good.
Toy Story?
Comedy
That's
sequels.
Not a comedy.
That's not a comedy.
Shrek?
I think in terms of, again, not really a comedy. If they're on Netflix, I don't think you'd think of them as the sort of thing.
Well, fine.
I'm thinking,
in that case, before we do this, can you tell me what a comedy is?
Basically, a comedy film is a film which is entirely there to make you laugh. It's not there to sort of tell another story. It's designed to be funny and slapsticky and... Yeah, the main draw, the main thing that you're there for is to laugh. Whereas other films, it might be that you might laugh, but it's an addition to hearing a story.
Well, I think our listeners would disagree with you about Shrek, and as I am in my head for that reason, because I think the primary drive of that movie is funny. It's a spoof fairy tale. That was the whole point.
Yeah, but it's a fairy tale, isn't it? That's the thing.
Okay, all right, listen. I can tell Phil's got the direction he wants to go in. Go, Phil.
I think you can normally tell a comedy... by the fact that it's not really designed to have sequels. Often these films are standalone films, and lots of them really successful, critically sort of acclaimed comedies don't have follow-ups. Or if they do, they really, really tank. So I'm thinking there's some legendary comedies like Wayne's World, which then had a sequel, and it went significantly worse than it did before. You've got Zoolander, which was, again, really well-regarded. Zoolander 2 didn't reach the high stakes of
Anchorman
the
previous 2.
Film. Anchorman 2 as well. The Hangover films. The Hangover first film was massively successful. Q2 more sequels, which were both critically panned, even though the first one was very well-liked and highly regarded. And often it's comedy films have a kind of key concept or a premise.
22 Jump Street.
22 Jump Street was one of the ones which I was going to point to.
I thought it was better than the first one.
Yeah, it's one of the few ones which is better than the first one. And it's a really good comedy sequel because it makes fun of how comedy sequels don't work. The whole premise of the film is comedy sequels are bigger, louder, more money is spent, and the product is worse. Well, it can't ever be as good as the first one.
Here's with it, man. What's your overriding thesis here?
My thesis is, basically, comedy is all about being fresh and unexpected.
Right.
And if you're getting a comedy sequel, you can't do either of those things.
Interesting. Okay, so the very nature of a comedy sequel means it can't be good, you think, even though I just proved to you that 22 Jump Street was. But you think that's because it attacked. It was fresh because it undercut its own first movie.
Yeah, it undercut the idea of what it was. It was lampooning itself.
Right.
And the whole fact that they were doing a sequel, it can't be as good as the previous film.
Fine. Okay. Well, so in particular, what does this rest on then?
I think this rests on the idea that the reason why people come to see a film like Zoolander is they want to see the characters again. They want to see Hansel being a bit sort of pretentious and loving Sting. They want to see Zoolander constantly doing the one look. But the thing is it's that repetition thing. The more that happens, the less there is a return on those things. And so comedy is having to basically bridge the two gaps of being familiar, which is why you come to see the film again or see the next film, and also doing something completely different. And basically, often what you find is a comedy film straddles both, and it ends up being the worst for both ends. It's overly familiar, and also it's too different.
Right.
So, for example, if you look at Anchorman 2, probably one of the biggest sequences of the movie was that newscaster fight.
Yes, I remember it.
And if you remember the first Anchorman, it was hilarious. It was about three or four unexpected cameos, and it was all ridiculous, and it was over the top, and it just sort of happened.
It was a gang fight in a back alley between news teams. That's a funny idea.
Very funny idea, very bizarre and random.
You think that is why it was funny? It was because what?
Yeah, you don't expect it. You don't see it coming. And also the people in it are just, they just happen to be famous friends of the movie makers. You almost get this sense of, oh, wouldn't this be fun? Let's do it. And you don't expect it to be violent. You don't expect somebody to be killed by a trident.
Yeah.
All those sort of things. And it just happens. And then it moves on. Whereas in Anchorman 2, you are expecting something like that to happen. And then it does happen. And it's bigger and louder in an attempt to try and elicit a more of a reaction.
No, I hear. Well, they got Harrison Ford. I remember him turning out. That was a
Harrison shocker. Ford. You've got Will Smith. Yeah. You've got Kanye West. You've got Jim Carrey. You've got Tina Fey. You've got Amy Poehler. It's just an endless list of ridiculous people. The joke isn't fresh anymore. It's already out the can. And as soon as you saw them line up and there was that news team, the joke is over.
So are you literally saying it's not possible then? Or are you saying here's how it can be better?
Well, so you mentioned 22 Jump Street. There's one franchise other than 22 Jump Street, which I think managed to do sequels that were as good, if not better.
Right.
And I wonder if you can guess.
No, I can't. That's my answer.
Yes. Austin Powers. Austin okay. Powers. Somehow, magically, I'd say Goldmember, the spy who bleeped me. That's probably made it sound even worse.
Yeah, no, I hear
you. But you know what I mean. Goldmember is a fantastic sequel, follow-up to Austin Powers, the man of international man of mystery. And the way that it gets around this is it has the same joke, but in a completely different way.
Okay.
The same joke, but in a completely different way. So if you remember, there's the silhouettes. That they do those sort of misunderstood innuendo silhouettes.
Yes, I do.
And in the first film, it was sort of something coming out of Austin Powers' bottom. And in the other film, it's Mini-Me is standing next to him, and it's about groin level.
Right.
And yeah, cue hilarious shadow puppet.
Yeah. Mishaps. No, it's very tastefully done. They are funny.
And it's clever. And the thing is because it's the same but different, it ticks both those boxes. It's fresh. But it's at the same time, you know what
but
to expect.
But then, I mean, to use your example of the Anchorman 2 fight, that is the same joke, but different. Different people, different setting, different scale, right? I think almost all of the joke in the original battle scene wasn't in the fight itself, it was in the surprise. So the Austin Powers joke, where he is covered up by different things as they move around in the room, what's funny about that is that you keep waiting to see what will cover them up next. You're not shocked and amazed that they were covering themselves up in the first place. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
So and that's what they've done in Anchorman 2. They've used different weapons, they've used different people, they've used a different place. The problem is that was never really what was funny about it in the first place. That's what I think.
It was the surprise.
Yeah, so it was a kind of a misunderstanding of what that joke was. Listeners, what do you think?
I mean, I think the other thing to mention is the fact that, generally speaking, I feel like comedy sequels come about because of comedy successes, like Bad Neighbours. Bad Neighbours had a small budget, made a lot of money, and so the studio wants to make another film that will be successful. Whereas I think, generally speaking, most of the time, comedy film writers and directors and actors, they're just wanting to make a funny film with no intention of having a follow-up or anything like that. Tell you who, one filmmaker in particular who is doing comedy in a very technical way, in a very creative way, I'd say it's Edgar Wright and what's his name? The little round-headed one in Shaun of the Dead.
Simon Pegg. What's round-headed about him?
He's round-headed.
Right. Okay.
Edgar Wright in particular makes some really well-crafted, layered comedy. It's not just in the lines that they're saying and how random and crazy they are. It's structured jokes and camera work that makes the joke
work.
He's
never done a sequel, though, has he?
No, he hasn't done a sequel, interestingly.
Yeah, maybe he stays away for that exact reason.
But what he does do is he does that Cornetto trilogy. It plays on some of the similar jokes again and again, like the fence gag. There's always a fence gag in the movie.
But you see, that's the thing, and that's an homage to it. That's like the Austin Powers thing. I mean, actually, you enjoy the same joke again because the joke is just funny enough, and it doesn't, you know, that's fine. It doesn't need to be fresh because it's not really about it being a surprise. It's actually about seeing it again and recognizing what's about to happen. And yeah, seeing the new way that they do that joke.
I mean, there you go. It's the same, but different. Like I was saying.
That is what you said earlier on, to be fair.
Right, yeah. At the very beginning. And it's straddling that sort of awkward thing about a comedy sequel where you've got to be familiar so that you're reminding them of all the
hooking
things.
Hooking in the fans.
All the things that they liked about the original, the reason why they're buying this ticket. So it's familiar and also at the same time unexpected. And I think Austin Powers really does that well. I think 22 Jump Street does that well as well.
No, I'd agree. It does make me wonder whether listeners have got any they think were awesome as well. Maybe we haven't seen, or any they thought were, you know, an absolute disaster. Because it is hard to pin down exactly what goes wrong with those bad comedy sequels. And it is striking, as you pointed out, that guys like Edgar Wright, who are brilliant at it, have stayed away so far from a comedy sequel. You know, there's no Shaun of the Dead 2 in the works, as far as I know.
I would argue, I think a comedy sequel is even harder to pull off than a comedy.
Well, listeners, what have you got? Have you got good examples? Have you got bad examples? What do you think the secret to it all is?
Let us know. You can tweet us at SuperBaileyBros.
Or email us at SuperBaileyBros@gmail.com. Have you ever noticed that when you do these things, you have to say the word at so many times?
It's just the internet these days. At least we're not having to say www.
No, you're quite right. But even when I write an email, I'm like, email me at Laurie at. And I think there's two ats in that sentence. That just bothers me.
What bothers me is that Subway, I have to say Italian BMT on Hearty Italian. And it's just too many times saying Italian.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Sort it out, everybody. That's what I say. So how does a 24 end, Phil?
Boop, boop.
Same again?
No, it's like more like just a sudden cut and then executive producer, blah, 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 blah.
Dramatic
and then dramatic music.
Well, listeners, imagine that dramatic music.
Or they do like a boop, boop, next time on 24.
Well, that's kind of what we're doing. And the Super Benny Bros is a bit bloopy, so here you go. We're not so different. It is the end of episode 24, listeners. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope you enjoyed our new format. We're trying to give you something that you know what to expect every week. We squeezed in a bit of what we've been watching, bit of emails, bit of movie reviews, bit of a little funny little think piece. Can I call that a think piece?
A feature, magazine feature.
A feature, thank you. And even a couple of emails got in there too, so let us know what you think of the new format, and we'll be back with, you know, all of the same next week, but different movies, different stuff.
And just to say, if you are worried that your favorite feature, I know people love Movie Court and they love movie news, man.
Well, movie news is coming back, we just didn't have any news worth saying this week.
Exactly, so don't freak out in case you were freaking out. I'm sure there's people desperately wondering if their favorite feature is in. It will make a return, just not necessarily every week, but some things will be here every week.
Yeah, good one. Okay, listen out next week, get in touch, do send us your Here Comes the Clip little stings if you've managed to record any. We've had an email, I know we had one email email which said they were going to get on the case. So
fantastic.
We're looking forward to hearing those. But other than that, I guess we'll see you next week.
And also do let us know what you thought of Bad Neighbours 2 and Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yes.
Give us plus ones or plus minuses, whatever.
Please do. See you next week, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So I don't know about the taste of this little bonus bit, man, but you're egging me on to do it. Last week, you may have noticed that the podcast was released at a later time than usual, on Wednesday evening, in fact, as opposed to the crisp and sharp 6 a.m. that Wednesday. And there is a pretty good reason for why. Are you sure about this, Phil?
I think it's just so funny. I imagine you're in this situation, it makes you laugh and also cringe for you.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. I edit the podcast and I go to a specific place to do that because I don't have access to this place's internet, and it just helps me to focus and get the thing done really well and quickly with my headphones plugged in. And it happens to be a place where there's a lot of people around. So you're surrounded by people. The weekend before, my daughter was ill. She vomited a couple of times. Then my wife was ill and she wasn't very well. And I thought, hooray for me and the Bailey Constitution.
You dodged a bullet.
I didn't get struck down by this bug. And then the day that I began the editing, I was sat there at my laptop. I got out early despite not feeling my best. I was sat down and I started to think, uh-oh, I've got to run. And putting away all the gear that I used to do the editing took so long that I was unable to hold it in, and so for the first time in 20 years I was physically sick in front of 100 people.
Where were you? Were you like in a hall or something?
Yeah, I was in a big atrium filled with hardworking people, and
what did you do in that situation?
Well, I regressed to childhood, because the last time it happened to me was so long ago. What I did, I stared at the floor and at myself for a second before realizing I had nothing to mop it up with. And I was covered, so I ran to the loo and sort of cleaned up and called my wife and said, what do I do? Will you come and get me, please? And then I kind of came back out with a big load of loo paper and asked if I could help, but they were already on the case.
Oh, my gosh. Are you going to go back there?
Yeah, of course. I don't think anyone will remember me. I certainly hope not. But yeah. Well, so listeners, were you grossed out by that? I bet you were.
I just think, oh, what would I do in that situation? That is like a living nightmare.
It was horrible, horrible, horrible. There was one moment where I thought, I'm going to be like, as it was happening, I thought, I'm going to be able to keep this, you know, under wraps. I'm not going to be able to let on that this is happening currently. But yeah, alas, it was not to be.
I think it's good for your ego, man. It keeps you in check and humble.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I was humiliated. There we go. Nice and cheerful. Guy. Bye, guys.